This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic Jon Stewart, anchors Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. Here's Stewart on last night's edition, talking about the recent NRA convention.
NRA members also pulled the trigger on an unprecedented third term for acting president Charlton Heston.
I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
Okay, cut. Chucky. It's a convention, baby. It's not the Omega Man. You gotta tone it down.
From my cold, dead hands.
It's all wrong. You're scaring the kids.
Jon Stewart took over The Daily Show in January of 1999. Stewart previously played himself on The Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling's spoof of late-night talk shows. Stewart also hosted his own interview show on MTV. On June 8th, he'll make his Carnegie Hall debut at the Toyota Comedy Festival. This summer, Stewart will anchor The Daily Show from the Republican and Democratic political conventions. I asked Jon Stewart what he finds silliest or most self-important about TV news shows.
The news shows basically function as entertainment shows. So our show can live in that area between what news shows ostensibly are supposed to be and what news shows are, which is just another vehicle for ratings for a network. So we live in sort of that area of you won't believe what's growing in your washing machine. What you don't know about it could kill your children. That sort of scare tactic. When they use their tactics of scaring and sensationalizing things just to get people to tune in. And that's, I think, the pompousness that we exploit.
So what are some of the stories you've done using the same kind of scare techniques as the news magazines?
Well, we did a big story on gravity and how it could be affecting your children, keeping them on the ground, et cetera, and what a dangerous thing it might be. It was just a huge promo with kids on a slide. You know, we used all the, you know, that empty swing on the playground.
Oh,
that
right.
They use every now and again to show that if you don't watch this thing, your child could be gone from the swing. I'm not really sure what it means. So it was about gravity. We did another one on Ritalin. And the basic premise of the Ritalin one was our correspondent, Steve Carell, listed all the symptoms where you could tell if your child had ADHD. And they were things like wants his mommy, keeps outgrowing clothes, which was basically every child in the country. And so his premise was everyone, all kids should be on Ritalin because it makes it a lot easier for parents. And while he was discussing all the various options, he was taking the pills himself, and he ended up tripping.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, you're going to be at the Democrat and Republican conventions, I believe.
Yes.
Have you been to a convention before?
I have been to a convention before. It was the Shriners, and they were wonderful. They were very open, not very much politicking. I did go, I think when the Democratic convention was in New York, I went to it one day when it was up at Madison Square Garden. And wow, is that boring. Talk about boring. Talk about a waste of time. There used to be, you know, remember the old days when, like, people would riot and stuff and they'd throw Dan Rather off the floor, you know, that kind of thing? Yeah, they don't do that anymore. Now it's just, again, it's sort of the entertainment value of it. It's produced like the Emmys in 1982. You know, you almost expect, you know, the First Lady to come out in a Bob Mackie. And, you know, they'll cut together some really cheesy montage about how they're trying to help people. And then every now and again, cut away to whoever it is has the characteristic that they're trying to help. You know, I remember when the Republicans were in their big tent phase. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
They used to talk about, hey, we're Republicans. We're inclusive now. And the nice thing about politics is you don't actually have to be the things you say you are because there's no truth in advertising there. So they basically go, well, we're inclusive. For instance, black people, we're very fond of them. And then they would cut away towards, like, there'd be a black guy in the audience, you know, and they'd cut away to him. But unfortunately, you know, they wanted to talk a lot about how they were fond of black people, but they only had, like, one black guy in there, so they just kept cutting away to the same guy. And after a while, I just felt like, geez, change your hat, dude. You know, at least make an effort to show that there's someone else there.
So what's your plan at the conventions? Where are you going to be? What do you hope to talk to? What do you hope to do?
Well, we're going to have, you know, we're putting together our list of analysts right now. We've got Senator Dole is lined up to be an analyst. I think former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will be there working with us. We're hoping to get a lead on maybe Senator Bob Kerry. You know, we discussed when we were in Philadelphia, we actually had Arlen Specter on the show a while back. So we're hoping Arlen will do some work with us again. So those are the people that we're putting together. The main thing is we're going to be doing our show with our correspondents out on the floor, covering this thing in the best way we know how. We're already putting together our Man from Hope films about the candidates and those kinds of things. We're probably going to be doing the evocative cutaway of the night, which will be, you know, if they're talking about child care and the cutaway to a baby in the audience, for instance, that will probably be our cutaway of the night.
If you try to, say, get an interview with one of the politicians at a convention, yes. Do you think a lot of them will, like, run the other way? Do you think a lot of politicians are afraid of being on a comedy show, that they're not going to be funny enough or that they'll be mocked?
There's a sense of that, but I think there's a more overwhelming sense of, is that a media outlet? Does that beam my image out to people's homes? Let me at it.
I think they've all hired writers. I think they've all hired, like, comic writers to zets up their jokes and write them jokes.
Right, but what, you know, that's not so annoying as the fact that they've all hired writers to zets up their policies.
Right.
You know, that's,
right.
I mean, that's the whole thing that's interesting to me is that comedy is sort of looked upon as a point of interest in political campaigns, and people talk about, geez, you know, when do you draw the line at a joke, and how do you go too far, and isn't it annoying that politicians are trying to be funny? And I don't find any of that annoying, because it's all under the guise of entertainment. What I find annoying is that they use the exact same principles to do that as they do to form policy. And that's I think, where we're in a little bit of trouble. It's not so much that you know, Gore hired a guy to write him a couple of jokes, depending on what crowd he was working to. It's that he hired somebody to make sure that his shirt tones made him look manly, and that his policies wouldn't offend the certain demographic that he thinks is a core element of the, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Jon Stewart, I first heard about you when you signed for the MTV show, The Jon Stewart Show.
First of all, thank you for calling me Jon Stewart. I think that's very nice to use my whole name, Terry Gross.
Oh, yes. All right. Okay.
You know what's nice about this, Terry?
What's nice about this?
You don't find me amusing in the slightest.
No, I do. No, what do you think? See, I'm going to stop you right here. First of all, let me explain something to our listeners. We are talking long distance. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And John's in a studio.
And I'm naked on an air mattress somewhere in Hoboken.
That's right. So, now you can't see me smiling with amusement.
I can't?
No, and unless I laugh out loud, you think you're really bombing in our studio, and you're not.
I have a picture of you sitting here smiling and nodding. It's on a bobble-headed dog.
See, but I'm just faking it in the smile.
Every time
these smiles I'm faking it in the photo, but these smiles are for real here.
All right, that's very nice, Terry.
Oh, I think it's really hard for a comic like you to be alone in a studio with nobody in there as an audience, not even me, not even your interviewee.
I think it's hard for a comic like me to be alone anywhere. I'm a needy son of a bitch. No, I'm sorry. All right.
Well,
there you go. No fake laughter, Terry. I won't have that.
See, now that's the thing. Now I have to just fake laughter to make you feel more secure.
No,
is that fair?
Don't. Not at all. Here's the thing. I feel tremendously secure by the fact that NPR has asked me to come on it. You have no idea the kind of validation that means to me.
So now we could both be very disingenuous and proceed.
Yes, I am. That my career is to be disingenuous. That's my whole career. If I wasn't disingenuous, I'd actually be helping people charity-wise. Think of all the crazy things I think about the government, and if I was actually a genuine person, I'd be out there doing something about it.
Oh, right.
Instead of writing a bunch of jokes.
Well, now let me say that I first heard about you in, I guess it was it 94 that you got the MTV show, the Jon Stewart Show?
Yes.
And you were being pitched as, like, the next hot young guy. And then less than a year later, you lost the show and you became the guy who got canceled. And I always wonder what it was like for you to, in a pretty rapid span of time, go from, like, the hot guy to the canceled guy.
Hot guy to canceled guy. Well, the truth is you're not really that much different. Like, when I was the hot guy, I wasn't any taller or better looking. And when I was the canceled guy, I wasn't any shorter or uglier. Do you know what I mean? You're still the same. That was a lesson I learned early on, is that as long as you have the ability to do what you do, which is write jokes, it really doesn't matter what they're calling you, because they don't live with you. Unless people in your apartment are actually saying that. That would be harder. Like if you woke up and they went, hey, you're the canceled guy. Hey, come on, I'm just trying to get some eggs. What's that canceled guy? You don't really hear that a whole lot. I mean, you read about it, but it's not like you physically feel when you're hot and when you're not. And in other words, you don't, I don't know. It's not like I went out much more anyway when I was hot or something, when I was on MTV. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But
they weren't like holding parades for me in the street. And every time I'd walk by, they'd go, it's the hot guy. Hey, everybody, it's the hot guy. And then I would, when I was canceled, they're like, we will shun you, like West Point. Everybody just turned their back and they were silent.
But don't you get more offers and more money when you're the hot guy than when you're the canceled guy?
I don't know. I mean, the big difference is I didn't have an office to go to every day.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like I didn't stop working.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe the money was less. I mean, it wasn't so dramatic, I guess. It wasn't like I went from an Oscar winner to a crack addict.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when I was the hot guy, I wasn't exactly that hot. I was, you know, my cable show looked like it was doing well. And when I was the canceled guy, it's not like, you know, it was Seinfeld, and I got dropped out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
It was like a pretty small-time deal to begin with.
Right.
So
got it.
I guess the disparity wasn't that great.
Yeah.
And also, in my barometer is more internal than external to begin with.
How did you decide to, like, try stand-up? What made you think that you would feel comfortable standing in front of an audience doing your 4 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever, you know, when you were just getting started?
I guess my work at Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess the fact that, you know, I'd done so well in that room.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a rhythm. It really is a rhythm that either makes sense to you or doesn't. It's, mm-hmm. I think it's similar to, you know, I would watch somebody who's a musician and just go, wow, that looks like magic to me. But I'd watch a comedian and go, huh, that's, yeah, all right. I could see why he thinks that. So it's a rhythm that makes sense to you. That is your, whatever your thought process is, that, you know, to get up on stage for the first time, obviously you're doing more of an impression of a comedian than you are yourself. You're writing jokes that you think are supposedly funny and that sort of thing. And then it takes a long time to sort of discover your own rhythm. But the rhythm itself made sense to me.
Did you do autobiographical stuff in your early...
Everybody does. The basic sort of... Here's the sort of evolution of man as comedian.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that little chart. You start out talking about your family. That'll get you about 20 minutes. 20 minutes of material. That 20 minutes of material gets you on the road. When you get on the road, you develop your 15 to 20 minutes of, hey, you guys ever been to Chattanooga? Hey, that's a crazy town. You know, they got a museum there of old cars joke. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you get your I'm a comedian on the road. Hey, hotels, come on, people, that's soap. Seriously, people, anyone? And then also you're spending a lot of time in rooms watching TV, so that's mm-hmm. when you first develop your, have you seen this commercial about the guy in the Kotex? So there's that bit. And so you develop your thing, and then at a certain point you exhaust all of that, and you turn to the events of the day. And that's, I think, sort of the general evolution of the comedian. So you don't, you know, and some people stay with the family thing all the time. They can mine that. But the majority of people move off of that once they've mined it. Because the problem is once you start being a comedian, you stop living to a certain extent.
Or because you're on the road all the time?
Well, you stop living a sort of a normal life. It's like with the rock bands, you know, everybody always writes their heroin song or their... Geez, it's lonely on the road song, you know. Mm-hmm. On a steel horse I ride, cause I'm a wanted, wanted, dead or alive. And I think we all know Bon Jovi's not actually wanted, dead or alive. I think we understand he's not an outlaw, but he is on a steel horse, a bus, a metaphor for the loneliness of the road. And so that's what we all do.
Now, you grew up in a neighborhood in New Jersey that you've said had very few Jewish families in it, and you were one of the few. There's, I think it's in Annie Hall where Woody Allen imagines what Diane Keaton is going to think of him when she takes him to meet her very non-Jewish parents.
Yeah, very funny scene.
Yeah, and he imagines himself with looking like an ultra-Orthodox Jew with payas and the beard and everything. Did you have a self-image about how you thought people in your neighborhood saw you as the Jewish guy in the neighborhood, the Jewish kid?
It was wrapped up in not just that. It wasn't pure, you know, we weren't Orthodox by any stretch of the imagination. But it was more just, I didn't have a vision of what I thought they saw me as. I saw what they saw me as. I was an ugly, ugly small boy. My head is the same size as it was now. My body was about a quarter of the size it is now. So I literally looked like a Jewish Peanuts character. I looked like Shlomo, the Peanuts character next to Franklin. So it was a giant head. And just as the body started to grow, my head decided to cover itself with acne. So sort of a no-win situation. But yeah, no, it wasn't. You got to understand, humor is about deflecting criticism in many ways. But that's not the only. It's a rhythm that I was comfortable with from the start.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come up with jokes because I thought, oh, if I make a joke, girls will like me. It wasn't cognitive. It was a rhythm that I understood somehow from the start, just as a very young kid.
Okay, now you didn't think that if I come up with jokes, girls will like me. But nevertheless, was it easier to attract girls when they realized that you were funny? Was that a help at all? You know, a lot of musicians say that they started playing music because it was easier to meet women that way.
Let me make something very clear here.
Yeah.
The worst bass player in the world gets laid more than the best comedian. So if this was an attempt to score women, here's what it did. Hey, John, go talk to those girls and loosen them up a little bit so that your good-looking friends can come in and get laid. Here's the thing. The first time I got to second base with a girl, I was in my car. I had a gremlin, okay? I was 17 years old. First time I got to second base, and it wasn't me doing it. It was a friend of mine with a girl in the back seat, and I was watching through the rearview mirror, but I counted it. You see what I'm saying? I counted it. I'm not proud of that.
My guest is Jon Stewart. He hosts The Daily Show on Comedy Central. And the show will be going to the Democratic and Republican conventions this summer, the presidential conventions. Is there anything you're really looking forward to and anything you're particularly dreading about doing the show from the conventions in the summer, from the political conventions?
Well, from a technical aspect, anytime you move the show into a place where you're not accustomed to doing it, there's going to be a lot of glitches, and we're going to have to overcome those. But the beauty of it is everybody's in it for the long haul. I mean, we're in it, and the excitement of being there and the excitement of feeling relevant, because we're not actually a news show. We're a fake news show.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not really relevant. We don't ever break news. We react to it. You know, if we broke news about something, it wouldn't be funny. If we made jokes about Monica Lewinsky before anybody knew who she was, that probably wouldn't have gone over so big. So we're really just a reactive comedy show, but we'll feel relevant because we'll be in the environment of the conventions, and that will feel exciting.
Is it at the point yet where there's, like, a lot of comics at the convention? Like, is Bill Maher bringing his show there, and you guys are bringing your show there? And do you fear at some point it will be like there's too many comics at the convention?
I really don't think the public would put up with that.
That's true.
I really don't. I think they are barely putting up with the fact that there's too many networks at the convention.
Oh, right.
They're not even watching it. I mean, most networks are scaling back their coverage anyway. They're not going gavel to gavel.
That's right.
You know why?
Why?
Nothing happens.
Well, but you have to hope that something does happen, don't you?
No. That's the beauty of it.
Oh, the kind of trite it is. Yeah.
Exactly. All we have to hope is that they make it seem like something's happening.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's the area we live. That's our house.
Well, good luck at the convention.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Have a good time there.
And I appreciate that.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the Comedy Festival. What's your stand-up act like now? I think most of us know you more from television and from your show.
I will be performing at Carnegie Hall on June 8th, and I will be talking about everything from the hoax that is the computer age to Ilian Gonzalez to my dog throwing up. It's that wide ranging.
Okay.
Does that make any sense? I've made no sense with you. I feel an immense pressure to be on NPR and to make sense, because I don't want to get that. You know, I was on NPR once before, and we read a story from my book, and it got, you know, you get those calls the next day. I'm a professor of history in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I take exception to Mr. Stewart's qualification of artistic merit as he said, poopy. Now I disagree with him. You indeed. And I'm returning my tote bag. Toot sweet. There, see? Terry Gross laughs at the NPR jokes, and that's it.
Jon Stewart anchors Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. On June 8th, he'll make his Carnegie Hall debut as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. By the way, I think that professor has called us, too. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.